Okay, so first I want to thank you all for having me here, and I realize it's the end of the day and you just lost your break, but hopefully this is a tight 30-minute presentation and then we'll have questions if there's any. This is a pleasure for me to come to Paris. My apologies, after all these years of coming to Paris, I still have not learned the language. You would not want to hear me try, so English will have to do. I put up some sort of, I'm known to do this, put up way too much information in this one slide, but I'll simply point to Foucault, the Panopticon as sort of a theoretical model of power, and Netflix culture as a different sort of theoretical process of managing people and in places outside of LA and Silicon Valley. So that's the sort of general schema of the talk. Up here is a tight definition of direct-to-consumer, which you may or may not, I'm sure you do, realize is what Disney and Warner Brothers have sort of claimed ownership of. And my argument is that it's becoming a mainstream model, and everybody and his brother is pursuing a direct-to-consumer mainstream business model. Including all the advertisers, including all the marketers, including everybody's trying to find direct ways to get to the consumer, and I'm arguing Netflix is among that group. So today's talk, Netflix Self-Disciplinary Work Culture, is part of my forthcoming book, which is called Tech Magic Portals, Taylor's Deficiencies and Logistical Nightmares. It examines the overt and covert infrastructural systems of governance used by Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, Disney Plus, HBO Max, and other US-based subscription video on demand streaming services to maintain aggressive long distance indirect control over their most valuable assets, which are their local original television series. As part of a larger initiative, I'm arguing, to embed themselves inside global markets. This logistical enterprise, which I'm going to spend 90% of the talk setting up, however, can fail if local workers decide to test the limits of the streamer's self-disciplinary ecosystem by refusing to conform to these digital guardrails. The U.S. streamers' globalization strategies rely on a significant feature of tech capitalism, namely the iterative infrastructure of power inherent in internet distribution, which functions as a logistical system designed to harness the labor of overseas knowledge workers who are tasked with transforming local originals into transnational hits. The goal of this talk is twofold. First, to expose the deleterious long-term impact on overseas creative labor and culture industries caused, paradoxically, by U.S. streamers' massive investment in international television series. And second, to unpack recent efforts by U.S. streamers to secure exclusive rights to local for global originals. Examples, which I'll be discussing, are Lupin, Money Heist, Squid Game, and Black Mirror. And the goal is to ensure that these, I'm calling local to global hits, function as experiential shop windows to entice transnational consumers to engage with their burgeoning 24/7 virtual marketplaces, otherwise known as direct-to-consumer ecosystems or shoppable TV. So if I haven't lost you yet, I'm playing around with the idea of Netflix uses a lot of magic, a lot of smoke and mirrors, a lot of PR. Some of you, even though my French is so poor, I can tell we're on a similar page, including Aurelia's last talk about, you know, which got a lot of laughs. My goal here is to have you critique and think about and unpack how Netflix makes itself seem like this magical organization. So complicating scholarly efforts to unpack these highly integrated localization, globalization strategies is the presence of two interlocking systems of infrastructural governance, namely the predominantly invisible systems of control associated with automated algorithmic technologies, which is a nod to Violaine's project. In addition to data analytics, you could include personalized curation, advertising technologies, or ad tech as it's known, and digital marketing or social media marketing. And the more visible expression of soft power is achieved when U.S. streaming services acquire high-profile real estate in overseas markets and hire thousands of multilingual workers in regional headquarters and local offices to manage the day-to-day activities associated with their multi-billion dollar media investments. As of late 2021, Netflix has hired 11,300 employees across 28 locations, and I'm arguing ramping up hires in their overseas regional headquarters and local offices in particular. As a byproduct of the technological utopianism inherent in logistical systems, the streamers' corporate public relations teams downplay the essential labor performed by their overseas workers and instead promote the automated software and digital technologies used to maintain their allure as tech magic portals. The Foucauldian system of self-disciplinary governance inherent in the Netflix work culture, for instance, which offers workers freedom and responsibility in exchange for fealty to the company, is viewed as an updated version of 20th century's Taylorist efficiency. That is, until one or more of the local creators and or office workers rebels against the machine by opting to protect their local culture industries instead of the interests of the streaming service. In their 2021 essay, Beyond Streaming Wars, Raymond Lobato and Amanda Lotz, two high-profile scholars that have been writing about Netflix, they observe that Netflix is the only SVOD service that is overwhelmingly reliant on subscriber payments and unable to cross-subsidize and integrate its video service with other lines of business. However, a counter-argument can be made that Netflix has been quietly laying the foundation for a global D2C ecosystem comparable to that of Walt Disney or Warner Brothers Discovery by automating online profit centers such as digital advertising, brand marketing, and e-commerce sales of media retail products tied to their fully owned originals. In other words, Netflix is not just underwriting the cost of originals, a projected $18 billion in 2022, to amass global subscribers. Instead, Netflix is using its analytic technologies to guide the actions of hundreds, if not thousands, of regional and local office workers tasked with tailoring the marketing and media retail solicitations linked to their most popular global media franchises, with Francis Lupin, Spain's Money Heist, and South Korea's Squid Game being prominent examples. While my book examines four interlocking long-distance indirect forms of governance over local for global originals, the remainder of this topic will focus on just the first one that I've identified, and to boot is going to be the first half of that section. Read my book for the rest. So section one, Netflix aggressive long-distance localization strategy. The U.S. streamers are stockpiling locally produced originals and using in-house algorithmic technologies such as data analytics and automated curation to maximize what Lobato and Lotz describe as the geographies of scale. Netflix justifies its massive investment in international series as part of a large-scale effort to outmaneuver legacy Hollywood studios' own D2C globalization efforts. The latter film and TV studios are refurbishing English language media franchises. You're all probably familiar with the fact that you're seeing reboots of Star Wars, The Avengers, and Batman, shows and movies that have been in steady rotation in overseas markets for decades in some instances. One of Netflix's counter strategies is to transform local originals that originate outside the U.S. into global media franchises. As Netflix chief executive officer Ted Sarandos stated, quote, "The exciting thing for me would be if the next Stranger Things came from outside America. Right now, historically, nothing of that scale has ever come out of anywhere but Hollywood." Another one of those annoying things he says. That said, Netflix is not singularly focused on non-U.S. originated originals, but rather is seeking to infiltrate global markets by mimicking legacy Hollywood's media franchising business model, as evidenced by the recent uptick in licensed games derived from Netflix's most popular originals, including The Queen's Gambit chess game and the single action player action game based on Money Heist. First, however, Netflix has to win over non-U.S. creators by offering the upfront funds needed to go into production immediately on their proposed series, which contrasts with most independent financing sources, international pre-sales, equity financing, that are slow and laborious. And this is a nod to Anna's, Vinuela's research in this area. In addition, Netflix promises that its superior digital distribution can deliver a global audience for its series, which was elusive for most non-English language creators during the network and cable broadcasting multi-channel distribution era. Even, I would argue, during HBO Europe's massive investment in quality local-for-local originals in the 1990s and 2000s. And again, I've left out this whole part of the talk, but many of you are probably familiar with HBO Europe's strategy, which I'm arguing is the opposite of Netflix. Netflix is all about how many local originals can we turn into massive hits, like one of the ones created in LA, versus HBO had a much more independent-minded model of let's find quality creators and let them do what they do in terms of local content. So some local production companies, such as France Gaumont TV, instantly recognized the value of granting Netflix exclusive rights to its locally produced originals, such as Lupin and Narcos, given the streamer's proven strength as a global digital distribution service for non-English language productions. Others, such as South Korea's prominent studio, CJENM, and its dominant streaming service, SK Telecom, were initially skeptical about granting Netflix global distribution, exclusive global distribution rights to its co-produced series, Squid Game, fearing it would undermine plans to use local content to strengthen their own streaming service. When CJENM and SK Telecom ultimately conceded, most industry trades, at least those coming from the U.S., credited Netflix with having single-handedly opened the floodgates for South Korean media practitioners, which of course ignores the last several years of global interest in K-pop and South Korean dramas. So, not all Netflix originals are the same. As Karen Petrushka and Faye Woods explain in their essay, Traveling Without a Passport, not only does Netflix foreground transnational universality and allied cultural specificity, but the streamer is also notorious for obfuscating legal definitions of intellectual property ownership by labeling the lion's share of its library Netflix originals, when in fact the majority of its assets are licensed content. Variety observes that, quote, original content accounted for only 37% of Netflix U.S. streams in October 2018, and that means the majority, 63%, of Netflix viewing is still from licensed content. In 2016, Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos advised nervous shareholders that the service would guarantee that at least 50% of its library would be fully owned IP, making the streamer less dependent on subscriptions alone. So, by the way, I really want you to hear that because it was kind of what sparked this whole project. It was in a shareholder report in 2016, kind of buried in the language, where, well, I thought, why is he saying this? Why is 50% a benchmark? And I realized, oh, it's because they want to do Hollywood style, which is to extract additional revenue streams beyond subscriptions for the stuff that is truly stuff they own in its entirety. So, however, complicating Netflix's plan to access exclusive control over non-U.S. originals are the various local and regional regulatory policies, the most recent being Europe's requirement that 30% of the U.S. streamers' libraries contain locally produced content. Hence, it is important to unpack Netflix's opaque and often arcane legal and industrial categories to decipher how the streamer ultimately won over even the most discerning media and entertainment conglomerates, such as Gaumont and CJENM and SK Telecom, based in part on its vague promise of raising the profile of non-English language series using a superior automated recommendation algorithm. So Netflix has burnished its allure among both creators and companies by invoking nebulous, non-scientific designations, such as what's known as an internal metric, another thing that sparked my interest. Well, what does that mean? That means that it's their internal metric for measuring the impact value of various commercial touch points. Again, you might ask yourself, what are commercial touch points? So Variety explains, quote, but Netflix doesn't release detailed viewing metrics, so third-party measurements provide the only approximation of how subscribers are using the service, close quote. Netflix has consistently eschewed Nielsen ratings, which in the U.S. is the more universally recognized rating system traceable to the earliest days of legacy Hollywood broadcasting. Instead, Netflix prefers to use its own internal metrics, in part, I argue, because of its lack of precision and evocative potential, to help perpetuate an illusory form of magical thinking among both subscribers and creators. Wendy Chun describes software as fetish in her really provocative book, Program Software, both as a byproduct of user interface design features that promote an illusory sense of user agency, and as a source code that disciplines workers by embedding what she says its bureaucracies within a machine. I, again, found that really helpful. Chun's observation that source code, quote, becomes a thing, the erasure of execution, follows from mechanization of these power relations, the reworking of subject-object relations through automation as both empowerment and enslavement, and through repetition as both mastery and hell, a constantly repeated narrative of liberation and empowerment, wizards and ex-slaves, close quote. In the current example, Netflix self-promotion, I argue, through repeated allusions to its superior software, is a constantly repeated narration of liberation and empowerment, one that casts Netflix as the wizard and the largely unseen labor of its regional and local office workers as the ex-slaves who have been disciplined into compliance. So Entertainment Database Studio System uses its industry aggregator site to provide clearly delineated categories of media content to counteract the obfuscation unleashed by Netflix and its other streaming services. Hence, they provide these four categories that are listed here. They list true originals, which is keep track of that category. It's the main one. Instead of just Netflix originals, they're true originals, co-produced originals, exclusive originals, and renewal originals. The first two categories of originals, the fully owned true original and the partially licensed co-produced original, are both central to Netflix globalization strategy and essentially the focus of this discussion. One of the clearest examples of true originals are big budget, effects-laden series such as Netflix, The Witcher, and Amazon's Carnival Row, which deliberately mimic the scale and global reach of HBO's fantasy history genre hybrid Game of Thrones, to the point where people, frustrated fans, are going, well, you know, why are they all so similar? Both series are overseen by the Los Angeles-based executives who are in charge of international television. Bella Baharia, who is pictured here in a very insipid photograph, is Netflix head of global TV and former president of Universal Television. And John Wax is the Amazon Studios head of genre programming and the former head of YouTube Originals. As you'll notice, they've been in this, you know, business for a while of creating Game of Thrones style projects. Netflix, The Witcher, and Amazon Studios Carnival Row were interesting to me because they were both executed by Los Angeles-based production companies and or many major studios in Hollywood, Hivemind Entertainment and Legendary Television, respectively, as part of their output deals with the U.S. streamers. While both true originals are L.A. productions, they were shot in the small peripheral market of Central Eastern Europe, inside the media capitals of Budapest, Warsaw, and Prague, among others, in part because of their historical architecture and evocative landscapes, but also to secure inexpensive, skilled media practitioners and access to local and regional government incentives. Netflix and Amazon's LA-based development teams, many of whom previously worked for the Hollywood studios, are experts at what scholar Derek Johnson characterizes as retail wizardry, an implicit rule book for constructing media fantasies like the Harry Potter franchise, which encourage a transnational consumer base to purchase point-of-sale merchandise. So I'm arguing both Netflix, The Witcher, and Amazon Studios' Carnival Row are what I'm calling global for global originals that rely on cultural hybridity, genre hybrids, VFX spectacle, bifurcated ideology, meaning presentation of both illiberal or conservative forms of sovereign power and superficial critique of fairies and witches who stand in as metaphors for immigrant cultures, to access a global versus local audience. Netflix and Amazon's regional and local offices have learned to craft legitimating marketing campaigns that marry specific cultural interests, such as the Ministerio de Fomento in Money Heist and the Louvre in Lupin, with a transnational imaginary, meaning things like class wars and duty to family, things we can all relate to reinforce a global ecology. The second category of true original under review is non-English language, locally produced series such as Lupin and Narcos, which replicate the work-for-hire arrangement outlined above. In this case, France's Gaumont Television, much like Hivemind and Legendary, agreed to forego an ownership stake in the series they produced for Netflix. According to Variety, Gaumont TV is, quote, the powerhouse behind Narcos, Lupin, and Barbarians, and most recently, Le Prince. Lupin and Le Prince are both mystery thriller series based on French lore. Meanwhile, Barbarians is based on Germanic history and Narcos is based on the Colombian drug trade in the 1980s. By having Gaumont Television execute local originals from at least three different territories, Netflix is effectively gaming Europe's regulatory policy that insists U.S. streamers' libraries contain at least 30% locally produced films and series. In addition, Gaumont is functioning as a creative matchmaker by introducing Netflix to seasoned television writer producers from different parts of Europe and Latin America. At the 2021 European Film Market, Gaumont Vice CEO Christophe Riandet, who is also the producer of the hit series Lupin, called it, quote, a great achievement, not only for us, but for all producers around the world, close quote. In other words, I argue, some of you may know these insider details about the French film industry more than me, and please, during the break, come and talk to me. In other words, local producers, I argue, feel obliged to publicly express their gratitude to Netflix for investing large sums in local media productions, masking any lingering concerns they might have about allowing U.S. streamers to become the primary beneficiaries of these valuable cultural assets. So by financing local true originals such as Lupin, Netflix is able to have its cake and eat it too by enlisting local production companies and studios in work-for-hire arrangements that grant the video service exclusive rights to global hits, which it can then cross-subsidize and integrate with other lines of business as an updated version of legacy Hollywood's media franchise business. In other words, I'm arguing, Netflix is laying the groundwork for its own globally distributed, fully realized D2C ecosystem, which is further indicated by the 2021 launch of the Netflix online shop. This is just a telling quote from the trades. Netflix is developing a version of Hollywood Studios' longtime revenue generator, launching an online store for branded merchandise. The boutique site, Netflix.com, features items like Lupin throw pillows for $60, Yasuke anime hoodies designed by Hypewear's Jordan Bentley for $74. What a deal. While initial offerings are limited, the shop will soon expand to include items for shows like Bridgerton, Money Heist, The Witcher, and Stranger Things. For now, the retail operation is up and running in the U.S. only, but it will reach global territories in the coming months, the company said. A third subcategory of Netflix original is a cross between a true original and a co-produced original and or renewal originals. I had to slide that in. Co-produced originals include Money Heist and Squid Game, and renewal originals include Black Mirror. These are co-productions between Netflix and local studios. Furthermore, local creators such as Alex Pena, who is the creator behind Money Heist, Charles Brooker and Annabelle Jones, the co-creators of Black Mirror, and Hwang Dong-hook, the creator of Squid Game, forged conventional independent financing deals with local media and entertainment conglomerates to get their previous projects made. However, each of them, including Squid Game creator Hwang Dong-hook and his original partners CJENM and SK Telecom, ultimately capitulated to Netflix's request for global digital distribution rights to their valuable media property, later attributing Netflix's global presence as the main factor of its success, close quote. Another one of those obligatory isn't Netflix grand comments. Meanwhile, Alex Pena and his Madrid-based production company Vancouver Media originally created Money Heist for the Spanish network Antena 3 in 2017. However, Antena 3 opted to license global digital distribution rights to Netflix, which prompted the streamer to become a more active creative partner by bankrolling season 3 through 5 of Money Heist. Like Dong-hook, Pena publicly credits Netflix with turning its co-produced original into a global phenomenon. Shortly before Money Heist concluded its run, Netflix offered Pena a lucrative multi-year deal, which granted the streamer exclusive rights to his future projects, including the local adaptations of Money Heist for Korea and India, all of which are now true originals, as long as Antena 3 forfeited its rights. In contrast, Dong-hook wasn't able to secure one of these grand multi-million dollar deals because CJENM and SK Telecom refused to give up their ownership stake. Smartly, I would argue. The creator, Dong-hook, dryly observed that he didn't even receive a bonus despite his series' extremely positive impact on Netflix subscriptions in 2021. In nearly all instances, Netflix agrees to pay a large upfront fee, but no residuals, to secure exclusive rights over the showrunner's future series only after its local office workers from disparate regions have successfully mounted a carefully coordinated global marketing campaign demonstrating their ability to transform the series into a global hit. Each time Netflix leadership team pursues a local original, I argue it follows a similar roadmap. First, the streamer limits its financial investment in the series by pursuing international digital distribution rights only. Second, if its internal metrics indicates fledgling interest from subscribers in territories outside the country in which the series was produced, Netflix agrees to fund additional series, thereby converting a co-produced original or a renewed original like Black Mirror into a fully owned true original. Third, after putting its localization teams to work on dubbing, subtitling, and launching both TV ads and social media marketing campaigns to local audiences across multiple regions, Netflix LA marketers organize a global press junket featuring the newly acquired creator who touts the streamer's ability to deliver a global audience. For example, the LA marketing team's TV and social media blitz portrayed Pena as an unknown Spanish creator who achieved success only after partnering with Netflix. This paternalistic and patronizing rags-to-riches narrative ignores the fact that Pena was a seasoned film and television writer, director, producer in Spain long before Netflix acquired Money Heist. While Pena was Netflix's first non-English language creator deal, it aligns closely with those offered to LA-based creators such as Shonda Rhimes, famous here for Bridgerton, Ryan Murphy, famous for Netflix, Halston, and Ratched, and also London-based creators such as Charles Brooker and Alison Jones, famous for creating Black Mirror and Bandersnatch, the interactive feature. Whether or not the resulting true original series derived from these multi-series deals with creators are successful, I argue that Netflix benefits from the copious amount of positive press the service receives for securing these important auteurs. Increasingly, Netflix follows the same well-rehearsed strategy by claiming it transformed these creators into globally recognized celebrities. The dark underbelly of these promotional campaigns and exclusive rights deals is the implicit mandate that non-English language creators and the regional and local office workers must become compliant employees who knowingly agree to reinforce Netflix's global expansion efforts at a cost to their own culture industries. Now, I mention creators because that's sort of the most, you know, awe-inspiring action on Netflix's part. But I'm also arguing that Netflix relies on the compliant office workers and localization teams from its regional and local offices to secure a transnational audience for its local for global hits by having them One, forge corporate tie-ups with local businesses, as you can see, you know, on the bottom here. Two, cast Indian and South Korean stars in local versions of the franchise. The Squid Game star was strategically put inside of the Korean version of Money Heist, which Netflix owns. And using familiar tourist spots in marketing campaigns, which you can see here in the Lupin promo. And also oversee post-production tasks such as translation and dubbing. So, in conclusion, we must ask why some local creators and office workers are able to jam the machine by creating and promoting works that support culturally specific local values despite Netflix self-disciplinary work cultures. Examples of this critical cultural specificity are evident when you think about Spain's auto workers wearing Money Heist signature red robes and Salvador Dali masks to protest their working conditions in the real world. Or when social activist Agnieszka Holland's Netflix series 1983 challenges Poland's illiberal government policies. Or when Squid Game's creative team focuses on South Korea's disparity between rich and poor during publicity appearances. In each case, I argue, the digital guardrails have given way and the local creators and office workers are able to override Netflix legitimating master narrative.